I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. How do you save a magnificent natural landscape by promoting city living? That's the mission of the Cascade Land Conservancy, which is working to make Seattle more appealing so that sprawl doesn't consume the Cascade Mountains that surround it. We'll talk to two leaders of the Cascade Land Conservancy about their work today on Smart City. And the world of public planning can sometimes seem closed off to the average citizen. Deb Ryan of the University of North Carolina, Charlotte is looking to change that by creating a virtual collaboration tool called Wiki Planning. We'll talk to Deb about creating a place where citizens can weigh in on the future of their city and how it works. All that, plus the latest news from Plant Edison and our City Views commentator, Walker Smith. Stick around for today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jean Duvernoy is the president of the Cascade Land Conservancy, and Allison Van Gorp is the Conservancy's agenda project manager. The Conservancy is Washington State's largest independent land conservation and stewardship organization, and they're looking to transfer the economic loss from not developing natural resources into an economic gain by developing the city. Jean, explain the concept of a land conservancy.
Land conservancies started out in life as organizations that really were focused on conserving precious lands, whether it's wetlands or forest lands, that otherwise might be lost to other uses, whether it be development or shopping centers. I think you see the Cascade Land Conservancy take that notion, particularly after we conserved about 120,000 acres, and recognize that this region was still changing in character, and really put it on steroids, if you will, and say it's not just enough to conserve those precious lands. We have to have an impact on the lands we're developing and on those lands that continue to be used for timber and farming.
How did you change your way of doing business so that you could affect land under development?
Well, first, we recognized that we needed to. And if you will, what we then said to ourselves is it's not just enough to preserve those individual museum pieces, those special lands. We have to affect the landscape across the entire region if we're worth our salt. So what we then recognized, if you will, is that we no longer had the luxury to have a strategic plan or sense of ourselves that we kept tightly to ourselves, that we had to go out and have a conversation with our entire community, even those people who you would think might make us feel uncomfortable, like developers and loggers and other folks who use the landscape. We needed to talk to everyone to get a strategic plan, an approach to our landscape that everyone embraced. So, Carol, our first step was, in fact, to have what we called the Cascade Dialogues, where we talked to literally 5,000 people across the region to come together with a view for our region that we all could believe in.
What were the points of tension in those conversations?
It was less than you might anticipate, less than you might expect. And let me tell you why. Two reasons. First, we said to ourselves, what we're about is conserving a landscape, not just for the next 20 or 30 years, but for the next 100 years. So developer, timber operator, conservationist, think about what you want to hand off to your grandkids, grandkids, grandkids. Once you say that, everyone takes on the long view, and a lot of the sort of day-to-day animosities and concerns disappear behind a really thoughtful conversation about what we need to pass on to future generations. Then we also said to ourselves, you get a lot more working together than fighting at each other. So let's talk about how we create a land base that can support conservation and ecosystems, that can support communities and affordable housing, and that can support a strong and vibrant economy. So let's talk about how we all work together to get what we all need. Folks wanted to see that we meant that. It wasn't just sort of campaign rhetoric, if you will. But once they saw that we were quite sincere in that approach, a lot of what you might consider the expected tension flowed away.
I'm surprised in a way that the
future generations was actually terribly compelling. It seems to me that in our political rhetoric, we're always talking about what's best for our children. And yet it seems, in the end, not really to matter, because people are most interested in what how it affects them. So I'm curious, the grandchildren's grandchildren actually worked.
Sure. Of course, we all discount the future for today, and this is no different. So let me step back and make two statements. And the first statement sounds rather hair-raising, but the second statement gives you a sense why, again, tension flowed away. The first statement is, in the Northwest, where we are lucky enough to live, whether it's climate change, oil scarcity, the degradation of Puget Sound, all those environmental ills we know of today, and probably those coming down the pike we don't yet know of, in the Northwest, there is one overarching salient response. And that salient response is that we need to learn to live within the footprint our society has already claimed for itself and simply conserve all the rest of it. Now, that is a hair-raising statement. But we follow it up with the next statement. We need to do that in the marketplace. We need to do it in a way that everyone remains economically enfranchised and feel like they've had a fair shake.
Okay, that then brings up the question of, what about those landowners who are outside the footprint within which we live today, and how do they realize the market value for their land if, in fact, we're not going to develop there?
That is the question. There are kind of two questions that we out here need to grapple with: how we build affordable housing in our cities, and how we make sure that the folks who own the land that we do not believe should be developed, how they do not see their land economically depreciated. Two big issues. So let me attack the latter one first. There are a variety of mechanisms that we have really tested out that bring value to conservation. And that's the trick. You need to look at conservation not as an economic drag on the land, but as another asset you can monetize. So here's how we do that. You can look at many of these lands as lands that continue to cash flow, whether it's because of their timber crop or their food crop. So for those lands that cash flow, it's a matter of, how do you finance their acquisition based on that cash flow? How do you find cheap and patient capital so you can afford to buy them and conserve them in their current use and not just develop them? Other lands we need to preserve outright. So it's a little bit of a different problem. How do you conserve those lands that you want to preserve outright? Well, there are a lot of different mechanisms that we are really moving ahead quite aggressively on. One of the most promising mechanisms is a mechanism I first wrote about in 1976 at Cornell University.
Wow, 1976, I'm impressed.
Yeah. So, and when I wrote about it, I thought this makes so much sense that it's going to be the reign of the land, the lore of the land within a couple of years. Well, here it is 32 years later, and I think we're finally figuring out how to use that tool. And that's moving development rights from those lands where you want to conserve them to places where you want to develop more intensively. That's right, transferable development right programs. They have not been hugely successful, but they are the most potent force for massive landscape development in a fair, and I want to underscore that, fair and equitable manner that we could hope to realize out here. So we are really exploring how we align large development outright programs with the need to massively support new infrastructure in cities. So for those cities where they're willing to take TDRs, or development rights, to build up and thus exhaust the development potential on the countryside, Carol, for those cities, those should be the first in line for real help in building up their infrastructure.
Which makes sense to me, but let me ask you this. Given that you've set a goal of living within the footprint that we inhabit today, makes a lot of sense to me. Good goal. It seems odd that we would view density as a bonus. Shouldn't density really be what we're seeking anyway, rather than making people buy for, apply for, pay for a bonus?
That is one of the hearts of the matter, and it is not an easy problem to handle. What we as a community have said to ourselves is that we want to live in these urban areas. So we are asking folks who own that property, those properties, to build intensely, to have an economic benefit from that as well. At the same time, we're saying to our woods and forest lands, we don't want those lands to convert. We do not want the owners of those lands to build. So we as a community are saying to those landowners, don't build, don't enjoy that economic benefit. What development rights allow, if they're done correctly and modestly and appropriately, is to just simply transfer that wipeout, that economic loss, if you will, on those forest lands and put them into the city where you're having a real economic gain, to have everyone economically enfranchised and share in the development and growth of your region.
Well, I completely agree on the transfer side. I mean, again, you're trying to compensate those that you're asking not to develop their land. That's wise on that side. All I'm saying is that from the city side, what you really want as normative behavior, right, is intense development.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, Carol. And what we're saying is incentivize the TDR transfers, whether through infrastructure payments, through some reduction in other processing expenses and costs so that they are an economic gain. But here's where it benefits the city as well. I think particularly in the Northwest, the area Allison and I know better than others, you can't have a great city. Seattle is great because of the region it sits in. Tacoma is great because it sits next to Mount Rainier. So you can't divorce a city and its qualities from the surrounding region. So shouldn't the city, as it grows, help to preserve that region around it so it continues to be great? And I can bring this really down to a very immediate level. There are a lot of watersheds in our region that service various cities that, because they have stayed in forestry, do not require expensive filtration plants. So that's a great economic benefit to those cities, and they want to continue to have such an economic benefit. As those cities grow, wouldn't it be a great situation where, as they grow, the development rights from those watersheds are transferred, in fact, into that city growth, so that situation continues? So you can see that the city residents can directly benefit from the conservation of the surrounding countryside. So I think there is a pretty good nexus that goes both ways in our instance.
Allison, you've been working with cities in the Northwest on something you call the Cascade Agenda. Describe that agenda and describe the role that urban leaders are playing in carrying that agenda forward.
Well, as Jean was describing, a few years back, we did something called the Cascade Dialogues, where we brought together the community to look at, you know, what was important in our region and how do we ensure that it stays that way in the future. And from that, we really came up with two goals. One was to conserve 1.3 million acres of forests, farms, and natural areas. And secondly, kind of the flip side of that coin, is we want to make our cities great places to live. And so I've been working over the past 2 years on figuring out really what that means. We came into this as a land trust, and our history was really in working with real estate transactions and conserving land. And we're now getting much more involved in the policy arena, advocacy, and working directly with local governments on planning policies. More recently, we've brought together a suite of policy recommendations that we're now taking out to our partner cities. We've got 10 cities partnering with us right now, and we're working with them both on policy development and even to a somewhat of a greater extent working with them on outreach to the community and looking at how do we talk with citizens in the community about issues of growth and development, in a way that's not scary and in a way that can relate to their core values. And so they can make informed choices about how our regional priorities, like conserving land and protecting farms and forests, how does that really translate down to the land use decisions that are made in their neighborhoods and their communities, and help them to make informed decisions that will contribute to that larger regional vision, while at the same time seeing things change within their own neighborhood.
When you say make cities great places to live, what do you really mean? What's your definition of a great place to live?
Well, for me, it's having, you know, a convenient lifestyle, being able to walk, bike, take the bus to my workplace, to the places I shop, get around easily, having a lot of social activities, cultural activities near at hand. For me, it's really that mix of convenience and activity that really makes a vibrant and fun place to live.
Do the urban leaders of the Northwest generally agree with that definition? Is that what you're organizing around when you go out and say we've got 10 cities bought into this agenda of making cities great places to live?
I'll give the mic back to Allison in just a minute. This is Gene. Let me just go back to Allison's question too. Particularly now, in this economic climate that we're all confronting, cities need to provide affordable housing. That is incredibly important. And we haven't really figured that one out yet. We really need to focus on affordable housing. That is the underlying basis for great communities. Mm-hmm. Good schools. We got to really solve our urban school problem so that families can afford and then can also see their children educated in the cities. And finally, jobs. We need to make sure the jobs are within our cities and not elsewhere. Now, that's a situation where I think now more than ever in this economic climate, we are starting to recognize that it's our cities that generate the new jobs and the new entrepreneurialism, and they are becoming more and more of a focus at all policy levels in that manner, and that's very helpful to us. Again, you can't have a great region without the cities to hold our populations, and cities are only great to the extent they're in a great region. So you see a great synergy here, Carol.
Yeah, I think leaders in our region are really looking at the economic factors, and they're looking at, you know, what is it about our region that will continue to draw in the businesses and the skilled employees that we need to stay economically powerful into the future, and especially as we come out of this economic downturn. What can we be doing now to set ourselves up for a better future? And, you know, having a vibrant, great city and meeting those conditions that Gene was saying in terms of having the good schools, the affordable housing that help the skilled workforce choose to live within our city, within our region. That's really what we need to do now. And that's what our leaders are looking. How do we set up that kind of a city? How do we put in place the fundamentals that we need to make sure our city is successful going forward?
Let me ask you this. You referred to a set of policies that you are advocating as part of the Cascade Agenda. What are the public policy changes that you'd both like to see from the next administration?
I'll answer a few, and then I'm sure Allison will have additional detail. First, I think it is terrific that we have an administration that is coming in and recognizes that cities are where most of us reside, and cities are where the future of this country is, that cities can be the family's best friend, that cities can be the environmentalist's best friend. Cities are not our worst enemy. So you're seeing a sort of mindset change in the next administration that will benefit all of us greatly, because most of us do live, in fact, in cities. Secondly, I think you are seeing a new administration come in that recognizes we've been living for a very long time on old infrastructure. Now, think about any business that would dare to continue to try to be competitive on infrastructure that is 50, 60, 70, 80 years old. You don't see businesses doing that. How can we expect our urban areas to remain competitive relying on such old infrastructure? This new administration recognizes that. And we've all heard that there may be some substantial infrastructure bills coming down the road that have some great economic benefit as well. It would be of great help if those infrastructure bills, as they come down the road in the next few months, also require smart growth principles to be embodied in them so that as we access that infrastructure funding, we use it to build cities that are compact, that are very sustainable, and that in our case really encourage the movement of density from our countryside into our cities so folks see density, but they no longer see sprawl as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we're really looking forward to seeing potentially coming out of the next administration and potentially these infrastructure investments that Gene is talking about is really putting in place the incentives that we need to focus growth within existing cities to really encourage that infill development that we all think is needed as a part of smarter growth patterns. And that might mean repairing our crumbling roads and bridges. Definitely will mean building a state-of-the-art transit systems both within our cities and between major metropolitan areas. And it means, you know, investing in the things that make our cities good places to live, from parks to libraries to schools, making our streets more friendly for walking and biking, and just putting in place the things that make cities fun places to live.
We'll have more from Allison Van Gorp and Gene Duvernoy from the Cascade Land Conservancy in the second half of our show. Now, for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
City budgets are in the dumps as the economic recession continues to affect cities all over the world. In these tough times, cities are looking around for ways to bring in some extra cash. The city of Chicago recently brought in some much-needed money when it secured a deal with a private company called Chicago Parking Meters to lease the management of the city's parking meters. It's a 75-year contract that will add more than $1 billion up front into the city's budget. According to an article in the Wall Street Journal, about half of the money generated by this deal will go towards stabilizing the city's finances and balancing the budget through 2012. In 2007, the parking meters in the city provided a net income of about $19 million, but that was at the current rate of 25 cents per hour at most meters. The rates for those meters will quadruple to $1 an hour next year. With this increase, the parking meter deal stands to be quite lucrative for the private company. But while some citizens may be upset about the rise in prices, others are hopeful that the increases and the privatization will cause people to think twice about driving into downtown. And as Chicago basks in the fiscal glory of its billion-dollar parking deal, other cities across the nation are finding little relief to get them through the economic downturn. The Department of Housing and Urban Development's Neighborhood Stabilization Program is up and running, but many cities on the receiving end of those bailout grants are left wanting a lot more. According to another article in the Wall Street Journal, the distribution of funds has perplexed many cities, with some areas receiving significantly more money for problems that pale in comparison to the problems of other places. The state of Florida, for example, received $541 million from the federal government to deal with its foreclosures, while California, with twice as many foreclosures, received only $529 million. To implement this stabilization program, HUD has been doling out money at the state, county, and city levels, offering big grants to cities like LA and Pittsburgh, and also to many states. But some of the hard-hit cities within those states were overlooked by HUD when funds were being distributed. These places will have to rely on their states to hand out the money they need to try to salvage their foreclosure-ridden communities. But with little funding to go out and a long way for it to spread, many cities are left to question how helpful the federal stabilization program can really be. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll have more from Gene Duvernoy and Allison Van Gorp of the Cascade Land Conservancy. And we'll speak with Deb Ryan about making participating in city planning just a mouse click away. I'm Carol Coletta. And for our podcast listeners, we have a special message. Here's our producer, Scotty Iseri.
Hi, Carol. How's it going?
It's always going great.
The show is going well so far?
Well, that's for the listener to decide.
Well, speaking of our listeners, we have this really great base of podcast listeners, right? We have thousands of people that download our show every week. They come to our site, they click on the link, and they download our show, and they can take Smart City with them wherever we go. And we often get really great comments and feedback from them on our site. So we thought, why don't we create a site for our podcast listeners? It's called My City. It's got forums. It's a social networking site strictly for the listeners of Smart City.
Well, I think it would be fun to get to know the listeners better because it's really, in a way, it's like getting to know the people we interview better. We're all in this together. We're all trying to learn how to make cities more successful, our own cities more successful. So I'd love to hear what listeners have to say and love to learn more about what they're doing, the experiences they're having, what they see that's interesting, exciting, fun, cutting edge in their cities, some of which I'd love to turn into interviews.
Exactly, and that's what My City is all about. So what I'm asking the podcast listeners to do is email me, my personal email, I'm giving this out. It's Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. And I'll send you an invite, join our social networking site, join My City, and make My City your city. S-C-O-T-T-Y at smartcityradio.com.
We look forward to hearing from you. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Let's get back to our conversation with Jean Duvernoy and Allison Van Gorp of the Cascade Land Conservancy. Before the break, we were talking about what the Obama administration can do to support the growth of cities as a salve to poverty, the environment, and the economy. I appreciate the nuances that you're both adding to the discussion on infrastructure because I increasingly hear calls for infrastructure, and the word infrastructure is always followed by roads and bridges. With no sense that that means road and bridge repairs, it sounds like it may mean a continuation of what we've had, which concerns me a great deal. Do you get some sense that in fact, there is a nuanced view of infrastructure in play?
Yes, I do. And let me back up and get on the soapbox. What we're all saying, Carol, what I think you believe is that cities really have a very vital role to play in our future. They are going to be where most of us live. We also need to recognize that people don't make living choices based on the public interest. They make living choices based on their family's interests. So unless we make cities really vibrant and spectacular with jobs and affordable housing, people aren't going to live there. They will continue to sprawl. This is all about creating an incentive, creating a magnet for growth. We need to make cities the choice to live in a person's personal interest, not just in the public interest. Now let me flip over to the question you asked. Infrastructure. My sense of, particularly some of the delegation out here, my sense of what Bruce Katz and the Brookings Institution is going, is engaging in, my sense of a little bit of what I've heard out of Obama, the Obama administration, and the president-elect's urban speeches, is that there is that nuanced understanding that infrastructure really means all the vital undergirdings of a city and not just the old new roads and bridges argument.
Yeah, I would say that in general, we've heard a lot of talk about infrastructure, but like what Jean was saying, coming from the Obama administration, as well as a lot of advocacy groups in Washington, D.C., that is, there's a growing movement right now to focus those investments to help our cities build the green economy and make the investments we need to compete globally in the future. If you look at Europe, China, they're building rail systems for the future, for the 21st century. And we're still back in the 18th century in terms of moving our goods, moving people between cities. You know, as we hit peak oil, gas prices continue to rise, we need new ways to get around. Making those investments now creates jobs at the same time that it prepares us for the future.
Allison, I couldn't agree with you more. If you look at particularly Europe over the last 20 years, they have really reinvested in their cities, and they are becoming economically very attractive. Well, if we want to continue to be the economically dominant or one of the economically dominant players over the next century, we need to reinvest in our cities at least as well as we've seen Europe do.
Jean, is that the next frontier for land conservancies?
I've talked to many of our colleagues in the land trust movement, and I've talked to a guy named Rand Wentworth, who's the president of the Land Trust Alliance. And I think land conservancies have a very important role to play in terms of helping to shape the urban landscape and helping to advance smart growth principles. because of our roots, we are organizations that really seek to get everybody at the table and make sure everyone feels like they've been dealt with appropriately and have had a fair shake. So as we move forward into a more collaborative political situation, I think the way land trusts do business is really in keeping with that. So I cannot speak for the movement, but I can certainly tell you for the Cascade Land Conservancy, that is very definitely our future.
Allison, Jean, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Carol.
Jean Duvernoy is the president of Cascade Land Conservancy, and Allison Van Gorp is their project manager. They joined us from their office in Seattle, and their interview was engineered by Mo Provencher at Jack Straw Studios. Our next guest is taking city planning meetings into the 21st century. A design charrette is a collaborative session wherein many people develop a solution to a design problem. That often takes the form of public meetings or brainstorming sessions among designers, but our guest, Deb Ryan of the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, has developed a way to take that process online. The result was Wiki Planning. Deb, public participation in planning, design, development typically frustrates everybody involved, and you've been experimenting with new online methods of public participation. Tell me about it.
Well, we call it Wicca Planning, and what it is an online method for engaging the public and increasing civic engagement in the public meeting process. So instead of people having to get in their cars and drive to public meetings, this really allows people to participate in public discussions from the comfort of their home or their offices and be involved in a way which is perhaps more convenient for them.
I love this idea. As someone who has planned many public meetings, I can see that this would be a huge advantage. Give me some examples of this method at work. Where have you used it?
Oh, sure. What Wicca Planning includes is, of course, an online survey, blogs, chat rooms, geographic mapping exercises, picture postings, a whole series of opportunities where people can participate in a discussion. So in many, many ways, it does the same thing that a public meeting would do or a design charrette, in that there are really three components to it, and that is to educate folks, to gather input, and to attempt to bring some consensus around different ideas. It really is not sort of a foreign kind of animal. It's all the same components that you would expect to see. They just all are grouped together in an online environment. We just actually finished the beta project for Wicca Planning, and that was here in Charlotte, North Carolina. What we did was we worked with the local planning department, and they were, along with CATS, which is the Area Mass Transit Authority, they were seeking public input and conversation about a proposed light rail station that was going to go into the city's arts district called NoDa. And so we launched Wicca Planning to provide a public discussion, about how the folks in that community felt about a new light rail station being located in their community.
And what was your experience with it? Did it improve participation?
You know, the interesting thing about it was that, as you said, you have lots of experience with public meetings, as do I, and it always is very frustrating because it seems like the number of people who come out are not necessarily representative of the community at large.
Oh, Lord, that's an understatement.
Yeah, and
you're being diplomatic.
Yeah. Well, it also seems that the people that are very content with the decisions that are being made stay home. And so you have a silent majority of supporters who really aren't weighing into a project. And I think the folks who run public meetings and maybe even elected officials are getting a skewed sort of understanding about how the larger community feels about some of the proposals that are underway. And so what we found through this was perhaps a large untapped reservoir of people who actually wanted to speak in a very supportive way about what the government was proposing. proposing. And that was, you know, that was a refreshing change from many of the public meetings that I've attended. We heard from a lot of people. Actually, in the 60-day course of this project in NODA, we heard from, it was over 700 people and over 300, almost 350 left comments. And the most surprising thing was not really that quantity of comments, but the quality of them. The time that people took, they wrote paragraphs and paragraphs about how they felt about the project, about NODA, about light rail, about the neighborhood in general. And it was just a wonderful way to get a conversation going about what was happening in that neighborhood.
Well, getting comments like that is good news, bad news, isn't it? Because the good news is you get those comments and you get lengthy comments and they're thoughtful. The bad news is you've got to find a way to process those. So how did you do that? How did you manage to read those and incorporate them into the process?
Yeah, the wonderful thing is that Wicca Planning records all those comments. So for elected leaders, they don't have to rely on a summary of the comments, nor does anyone in the neighborhood. Anybody at any time can go and read all the comments that are there. So they're getting the raw data. At the end, we also summarized them and did a tally and grouped them into what the most significant issues were.
Deb, does it make more sense to use this method as a standalone or in combination with live meetings?
A lot of people have asked me that, and I think that my analogy is really that right now I would say in combination with other meetings. And the analogy that I use is sort of in terms of travel planning. And I think like 15 years ago, if I was going to go to Europe, I would have used a travel agent. Now if I'm going to Europe, I don't call a travel agent. I do it all myself. But sometime in between those 50 years, I was about at a halfway point where, you know, I would call a travel agent and do some of it myself. And I kind of think that's where we are in terms of public engagement and technology, is that I'm not sure we're ready to jump all the way to one side of the issue yet. I think that being able to have both formats is probably where we need to be right now.
Surely people push back and say, well, poor people don't have access to technology. Older people aren't comfortable with technology. What's your response?
Yeah. Actually, when we advertise Wicca Planning, we also go to the trouble of finding out where there are free access computers in the community. And we always advertise those locations. We also go into the libraries where those free computers usually are and put up signboards so that people who are using those free computers will know the project exists and invite access. We've been toying with the idea of having computers, terminals at festivals so that anyone at the festival can come to the site as well. And then relative to the question of the elderly, you know, one of the things that we do online is that we ask folks after they participate to undertake a demographic survey. And what we find is that we've got quite a few folks over 55 online.
Wait a minute. Elderly. 55. You are hitting in very near territory here.
I'm sorry. So
I hope many of my listeners are completely offended now.
That was 55 and older. I meant to say 70 and older. That's what I meant. And I still may have offended somebody there.
That's right. You know, actually, let me ask you a technology question, because I'm online 24 hours a day. I've got every latest gadget. I mean, I carry a BlackBerry and an Apple and an iPhone and a laptop. I mean, I'm ridiculous. But I have to admit, wikis are confusing to me. Even when my staff has tried to set up wikis, I find people don't use them, even the people much younger than me in the office. And I tend not to use them just because I can't say quite why they feel, I don't know if it's messy or I can't really tell you why. But again, I'm somebody who gets more than 100 emails a day and responds to them all. Or tries. Does the interface for the wiki planning look like a typical wiki?
I don't think so. I'll tell you, and I feel your pain on that one, because I do think that an awful lot of websites are set up by people who are very, very skilled and knowledgeable about the internet. We actually created this site ourselves and were architects, landscape architects, and urban designers. So we couldn't make it too complicated because we didn't know how. And so we put it together from the perspective of allowing folks who might not be quite as internet savvy as others that they would feel comfortable on the site. So we did purposely keep it very visually simple. There aren't a lot of bells and whistles, and because we thought that the more complicated we made it, we might be limiting some folks from participating. So it's a very, very simple, very, very straightforward site, and that was done intentionally.
Tell me this. What would using this method for public participation tell me that perhaps a live charrette or other methods of live public participation would not? You've mentioned one, and that is that it captures all of the comments in full. So if I choose to read them all versus read the staff summary, I can, in fact, do that as an elected official, say, or a decision maker. Are there other ways in which you think this method is fundamentally more valuable than live meetings?
I think what really matters is getting input from the diversity of the population that you're trying to serve, and that public meetings tend to attract a very small demographic of folks. And so what this does is decision makers to hear from a much broader constituency. You know, for instance, folks with handicaps generally do not attend public meetings. They can obviously have their voices heard here. You already mentioned the elderly. They tend not to come to public meetings as well. Shift workers, folks on hourly wages generally can't attend. And so if the desire is to have a much diverse pool of people that are being heard from, I think that this offers that.
It's interesting. I was speaking to Waterfront Toronto recently, just in the last few weeks, and they were having their general meeting, and it had a very homogenous look to it in terms of the audience. And the president of that organization told me that they have a real tough time getting young adults out to their meetings because, again, they're online. So I would think you'd pick up a lot of young adults participating online versus coming to a public meeting.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, we joke that most of the folks who come to public meetings tend to be white male and have gray hair. And rarely do you find people under the age of 30 that show up. And I think the important thing about that is if we're talking about urban planning, we're talking about urban design, we're talking 20 years before these ideas are actually realized. You know, we're designing cities for folks 20 years from now, and we've got to have those folks in the room. We've got to have, you know, the under 30 crowd in the room so that perhaps they can contribute to the city of the future.
Well, that was Waterfront Toronto's point entirely. Let me ask you this. What range of problems or challenges or opportunities in cities do you think wiki planning could be used to tackle?
It's more a question of what it can't tackle at this point because, you know, we've been approached about doing a whole range of options, anything from wayfinding systems and signage design to show alternatives online and let people weigh into placement and what the signs look like, to strategic plan and visioning and having people comments on values and communities. We've been approached about doing visual preference surveys. It's hard to imagine that there's not a component that this could help. I'm sure there are some, but I have yet to come to one that I can't make it work for.
It's such an interesting idea. Looking at your website, Deb, which is wonderfully simple and clean, I wasn't clear. Do you provide the service, as in the content, or will you provide simply the tool?
We provide the service. So it's set up so that if a community knows exactly what they want to know, then we will just host that service for them and post that information. But if it's someone who doesn't quite know what they want to know, then we can also help them with that. given, you know, our urban design background. But I think relative to that question in terms of the service, it is a service that we provide, and you know, the scale of it is suited to what the particular needs of that community are.
What future do you imagine for online public participation? Is this going to become the way of the future? Is this going to become the norm? And if you think it will become the norm, how long do you think it will take?
I don't think it is the future. I think it is now. And the reason I say that is if we look at Barack Obama's campaign and the success he had, not just in terms of raising money, but raising consciousness and engaging so many people in his campaign and continuing to do so after the election. Look, I think we're already here, and I think really the sky's the limit. He's set a really good example on a national level. Our hope is to work in a similar vein at a community and neighborhood level.
Deb, how did Wiki Planning come about?
Well, for a number of years, I ran something called the Urban Open Space Leadership Institute, and it looked very much like the Mayor's Institute, which I know you know all about. And it was sort of a local version of that. And so what we did was we worked with locally elected leaders, not just mayors, but city council members, county commissioners, and helped them better understand growth issues in their communities. And, you know, the funny thing about doing that is that it's set up to suggest that somehow we are teaching them, but while we are helping them understand the issues from our perspective, we are better understanding the sort of decisions they have to face. And so we learn a lot from them in the process as well. And in that interchange, one of the things we learned was how unhappy they truly were with the public participation process and how they truly felt that they weren't getting good input into the decisions they had to make. And so they actually said to us, you know, there must be a better way. And, you know, about the time that I was working on those institutes, I read Wiconomics, and I thought, you know, there must be a way to somehow bring these two causes together. We ought to be able to use the new interactive Web 2.0 in a way which is interactive that can bring more people into the tent and more people into the decision-making process. So this actually grew out of the Open Space Institute and the elected leaders' desire for something that was more accountable and more accessible.
That's a very interesting place to begin. Deb, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Deb Ryan is the creator of Wiki Planning. For a link to the site and to see what online collaboration has accomplished, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. This week, our City Views commentator is feeling a bit nostalgic. Walker Smith brings us this story about the places we live and the things we do to make them blossom.
The first apartment my wife and I rented was the end unit of a small, four-unit, one-story, L-shaped cinder block building. It was halfway down the street of a borderline neighborhood that got a little more run down each year. But it was close to a bus stop, and it bordered a green belt growing along a creek bed, so we thought it was heaven on earth. We probably spent more time decorating and cleaning that apartment than any place we've lived since. Of course, it needed lots of extra attention. It had a wall unit heater that would blow warm air out of a single set of vents, like the unit in a hotel room, only vertical. In the depths of winter, it would turn on at low speed, then eventually rev up to high speed and go on for hours. And even with all that racket, my nose was running all the time because I could never get warm. Our next-door neighbors were a couple just like us. Doug was in graduate school and Chris worked. They had an old male cat named Reggie who would jump onto our screen door and get stuck hanging there until we would come out and pry his claws out from the mesh. When Chris became pregnant with the first of their two daughters, we could hear her through the walls playing Ready or Not by Jackson Brown on their stereo over and over again all day until Doug came home from school and she could tell him. They moved out before us, and we've lost track of each other over the years. But every now and then, Joy and I will circle by that old building just to see how it's doing. The only difference we can see after all these years is the size of the butterfly bush that Joy planted there one afternoon. Not only did Joy fix up our apartment, she was determined to beautify the entire complex. So one day she rented a pair of hedge clippers and cut back every bush and hedge growing around the building, front and back. At one point, Doug came out just to sit and watch. Joy was in fine form that day with a lock of hair that had escaped the bobby pins, plastered to her sweaty forehead, and manhandling the extension cord with oversized yard gloves on her hands. By the time she finished, there was very little green left on any of the bushes, but they were all neat and even, ready to grow out again with a more tidy appearance. Doug pronounced it the best job of bush lopping that he'd ever seen. So loppers is what Joy and I call hedge clippers to this day. After finishing with the bushes, Joy got around to what she really wanted to do, which was to plant her butterfly bush. She had given it the room it needed to grow, and we looked forward to seeing it blossom. But we never got the chance. We moved the next year to what we thought would be a better place, never realizing that we had already lived in the place that would hold the most memories for us for the rest of our lives. No one who has lived there since seems to have cared as much about the bushes as Joy. In fact, that butterfly bush has taken over. It is huge today, towering over one end of the building where it burst into color each year, attracting an annual horde of butterflies. Joy left that place more beautiful than we found it. And I suppose there is nothing more you can ask of the past than that. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, and he comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. We always look forward to your feedback about the show. Send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com or go to our website and click on the contact button. While you're there, you can listen to archive shows, subscribe to our podcast, or register for our weekly newsletter. It's all online at smartcityradio.com. Our web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. His parakeet loves the sound of my voice. I'm Carol Coletta.